You seem like a good talent to have. He put me in touch with the famous porn impresario, Princess Donna Delore of Kink Studios. We swapped emails. Growing up, I was ashamed of everything, she wrote, and at a certain point I realised that if I was open with the world about the things that embarrassed me, they no longer held any weight. I felt set free. She added that she always derives her porn scenarios from that formula. She imagined circumstances that would mortify her, like being bound naked on a street with everybody looking at you. And then she enacts them with like-minded porn actors, robbing them of their horror. Donna and I arranged to have dinner in Los Angeles. That morning I emailed her, "See you at 7 p.m. tonight." At 5:40 p.m. I emailed her again. "Don't forget that we're supposed to be meeting in 1 hour and 20 minutes. "Sure," she replied. I arrived at the restaurant at 6:50 p.m. 2 hours and 10 minutes later, still sitting there, I checked her Twitter feed. Her last message, written 4 hours earlier, read, "Somebody please tell me what the fuck I am supposed to be doing at 7 p.m. Why the fuck don't I write this shit down?" I trudged miserably back to my hotel. If keeping people waiting in restaurants for hours is what it's like to live in a post-shame world, I thought, give me a bit of shame. At midnight, Donna emailed me. "Fuck, I am so sorry." "That's fine," I emailed back. "There's a public disgrace tomorrow if you want to come," she emailed. It was midnight outside a sports bar in the San Fernando Valley. From the front, the place looked dark and empty, all shuttered up. But Donna had told me to go around the back to the fire door behind the bins. When Max had told me how impressive Kink was, he didn't mean this sports bar. Kink headquarters is a giant, ornate 1914 armory in San Francisco, equipped with all sorts of dungeon and torture equipment. I knocked on the fire door. A security guard ticked me off a list. I scanned the bar room. There were 20 people in there, middle-aged men sitting alone, some young couples. Everybody looked nervous. A man walked over to me. "I'm Shyla," he said. "Shyla Kobe." "Are you a porn person?" I asked him. 23 years, he said. "It's all I know." He had a sweet, melancholy face. He reminded me of Droopy. I asked him a bit about his life. He said he didn't just work with Donna. He was a producer for hire, averaging 50 porn shoots a year, which meant he had 1,000 credits in all, including, I later discovered on IMDb, Orgy University, Wet Sweaty Boobs, and My Slutty Friends. "So what's the plan for tonight?" I asked him. Shyla shrugged. "Same as always. They fuck. He finishes. We clean up. Everyone goes home." He gently squeezed my arm to make sure I was okay. He wasn't the only one. Various members of the production crew kept doing it to me all night, rubbing my back, squeezing my arm. I suppose being tweedy and owl-like, I just don't look like the sort of person who normally hangs around extreme porn shoots, and I think everyone wanted to ensure that I was not feeling intimidated or about to faint. It was sweet. Porn professionals were being so nice and considerate towards me, it was almost as if I was the person about to have their genitals electrocuted. But it wasn't to be my genitals. It was the genitals of the porn actor Jodie Taylor, who was sitting in the corner of the bar discussing logistics with Princess Donna, who now stood up, hushed everyone, and made a speech about what was expected of us. "So," she began, "the name of this site is Public Disgrace. It's a site about public humiliation. You guys are all just people drinking and having a good time, and you have no idea that we're going to be turning up at this bar. When we come in, you're all invited to participate to a certain extent. You can grope the model, assuming you have clean hands and short filed fingernails. We have nail clippers and nail files if anyone thinks they're going to need them. You can smack her ass, but this is not about you showing us how hard you can smack someone. I don't want to see anyone take full swings. Sometimes people try and show off with their spanking. I'm sure you guys can all spank very, very hard, but I don't want to see it. Other things you can do. You can spit on her body. You can pour your drinks on her. You can pull her hair. You can gently smack her in the face. But try not to be too obnoxious. You are totally welcome to shout things out and verbally degrade her. That is encouraged. But just don't be that guy. She summarised. So, don't get shit-faced. Don't fist her ass. Enjoy. Donna and Jody Taylor disappeared to a corridor outside where Donna attached a ball and chain to her. She gave a signal to the cameraman. He pressed record, and it began. The drinkers feigned surprise at the sight of Donna pulling a shrieking Jody Taylor into the bar. "What is going on?" said a man in a beanie hat. He slammed down his drink in outrage. Donna ripped off Jody Taylor's clothes and attached electrodes to her genitals. "What are you doing?" said the man. He seemed to be the only crowd member daring enough to improvise dialogue or simulate emotion of any sort. "It's electricity," Donna said. "Do you want to shock her?" "Do I want to shock her?" he said. "I just came in to get a drink." "Oh, okay." Donna handed him the remote control. He pressed the button. Nothing happened. "Turn it off and turn it on again," said Donna. He did. Then he pressed the button. Jody Taylor screamed. Later, during a break from filming, a few crowd members expressed doubt that there really was electricity coursing through the pads and into Jody Taylor's genitals, so one of them pressed the pad against her hand and pressed the button and shrieked. Later still, I got an email from Jody Taylor. "Obviously, if something like public disgrace happened to me in real life, it would be extremely intense, horrifying and awful. But that's the beauty of porn. You can actually do these crazy things without actually doing them. It's all make-believe. It's pure fantasy, and a fantasy is never humiliating or scary. It's awesome. Princess Donna is all about making the porn girl's fantasy come alive, far more than the fantasy of the people viewing it. Only with her can you have fantasy as taboo as gangbang or public disgrace and actually get to live it out while being completely safe and comfortable." Shia Kobe had told me that the crowd was comprised of friends and friends of friends, with one exception. A hired porn actor was mingling amongst us, and now he emerged and started having sex with Jody Taylor. At this, everyone became a bit bolder, if still slightly stilted. "Put ice on her tooth," a man shouted. Someone poured beer over Jody Taylor's head. I tried to maintain a respectful distance, but from time to time, when needing to ensure that I was accurately chronicling the minutiae of it, I think I drifted into shot. And so, if you are a public disgrace viewer and the erotic ambience was ruined for you by the sudden emergence of a bespectacled man peering in close and writing things in a notepad, I'm sorry. I just hope that a few subscribers out there happen to find the image of a tweedy, owl-like journalist at an orgy stimulating, although I understand that this would be a niche quirk. The filming dragged on for hours. Donna had implied that it would be over by midnight, but 1 a.m. became 2 a.m. I desperately yearned for it to be over. "Please ejaculate," I silently urged the man, "so I can go to sleep." In this way, I imagine I was like millions of women before me. And then they finally finished. Shyla cleaned up, and everyone went home. Later, I spent a little time with Donna. I told her I thought she'd definitely created a more mindful working environment than most regular offices. There were no bullying bosses stalking around shaming the employees. "Are other corners of the porn industry more frightening and exploitative?" I asked her, "and that's why everyone here was making a special effort." Donna nodded, but said she didn't want to talk about other parts of the porn industry. She wanted to talk about what she was trying to achieve with public disgrace. "America is a very puritanical place," she said. "If I can help one person feel less freakish and alone because of what they like, then I'll be a success, but I know I've already reached more people than that." A few weeks passed, and then I received an interesting email from Max Mosley. Like me, he'd been thinking a lot about what it was about him that had managed to stave off even the most modest public shaming. And now, he wrote, he thought he had the answer. It was simply that he had refused to feel ashamed. As soon as the victim steps out of the pact by refusing to feel ashamed, he said, the whole thing crumbles. I reread Max's email. Could that be it? Does a shaming only work if the shamee plays their part in it by feeling ashamed? There was no doubt that Jonah and Justine too had been having intense conversations with their shame, whereas Max was just refusing to engage with his at all. I wondered, was unashamedness something that some people just had, or was it something that could be taught? And that was how I discovered a man teaching a course in how to refuse to feel ashamed. Chapter 8, The Shame Eradication Workshop. 12 Americans, strangers to one another, sat in a circle in a room in the J.W. Marriott Hotel in Chicago. There were button-down, preppy-looking businessmen and women, a young Burning Man-type drifter couple, a man with a Willie Nelson ponytail and deep lines in his face. In the middle sat Brad Blanton. He was a large man. His shirt open to his chest was yellow-white, like his hair. With his sunburned face, he looked like a red ball abandoned in dirty snow. Now he stirred. To begin, he said, I want you to tell us something that you don't want us to know. A lot of people move around in life chronically ashamed of how they look or how they feel or what they said or what they did. It's like a permanent adolescent concern. Adolescence is when you're permanently concerned about what other people think of you. It was a few months earlier when Brad Blanton and I were talking on Skype. He was telling me about how, as a psychotherapist, he had come to understand how so many of us live our lives constantly in fear of being exposed or being judged as immoral or not good enough. But Brad had invented a way for us to eradicate those feelings, he told me. His method was called radical honesty. Brad Blanton says we should toss out the filters between our brains and our mouths. If you think it, say it. Confess to your boss your secret plans to start your own company. If you're having fantasies about your wife's sister, Blanton says to tell your wife and tell her sister. It's the only path to authentic relationships. It's the only way to smash through modernity's soul-deadening alienation. A.J. Jacobs, I Think You're Fat, Esquire Magazine, July 2007. Brad's thinking was that shame grows when we internalise shame. Just look at the frantically evasive Jonah, whereas look at Max Mosley. Brad's favourite animal was a dog. A dog doesn't lie. A dog doesn't feel shame. A dog lives in the moment. Max Mosley was like a dog. We should be like dogs. And our first step towards being like dogs was to reveal to the group something about ourselves that we really didn't want people to know. By coincidence, my friend, the writer and broadcaster Starley Kine, took Brad's course a few years ago for a book she's writing. I met Starley before I flew to Chicago. I told her not to tell me what to expect. I wanted to be surprised. But she did tell me this first part. She said it always begins with the participants being asked to reveal a secret. With my group, Starley told me, the first man said that his secret was that he hadn't paid taxes in 10 years. Everyone nodded and looked disappointed that his secret wasn't so sensational. Then the next man said that his secret was that he had once murdered a man. He was in a truck with a man and he punched him in the head and threw him out and the guy was dead and another car ran him over and he didn't go to jail and he never told anyone. What did Brad Blanton say? I asked Starley. He said, next, great. Then it gets to the next woman. She said, oh, my secrets are so boring. I suppose I can talk about how I have sex with my cat. Then the murderer raised his hand and said, excuse me, I'd like to add something to my secret. I'd like to add that I also have sex with my cat. Starley had found Brad's course crazy. I probably would have too, had I not been seasoned in the destruction of Jonah and Justine, and the salvation of Max. Well, began a woman called Melissa, sitting opposite me in the circle. Melissa was a successful lawyer, but her passion was sadomasochistic sex. Humiliation is my biggest turn-on, she said. She's even built herself her own private dungeon. But Melissa's sex dungeon wasn't her secret. Her secret was that she earned more than $500,000 last year and felt ashamed to have earned so much. Later, when I recounted this to Starley, she explained to me that Melissa is actually a regular at Brad's workshops. She's Brad's protege. Melissa tells everyone about her dungeon, Starley said. How you respond to it is her way of judging how enlightened you are. Vincent sat next to Melissa. His secret was that he was beginning to regret signing up for Brad's course. It was a snap decision and $500 is a lot of money for me, he said. I was going to spend it on visiting my girlfriend in Thailand. Has he paid in full? Brad asked Melissa. Only the $150 deposit, Melissa replied. Get his money, Brad said to Melissa. Brad was making the radically honest statement that he was more concerned about getting the $350 Vincent owed him than assuring Vincent that he'd made a good decision signing up for the course. Can I pay you what I owe you in the break? Vincent asked. Brad shot Vincent a suspicious glance. Emily spoke next. Her secret was that she sells marijuana for a living. Like by the ounce, someone asked her. By the pound, she replied. I charge about $3,400 a pound. Are you worried about being caught? I asked her. No, she said. We're very discreet, Emily's boyfriend Mario told the room. Mario's secret was that he sometimes tells Emily he thinks she's fat. You're not fat, I said to Emily. Mario's other secret was, I use my lucid dreams as opportunities to rape women. I find the first girl that's around and I do whatever I want. I have my way with her. Can I be the star of your next dream? Said Melissa. I had a headache. Does anyone have any headache tablets? I asked the room. Melissa reached into her pocket and pulled out a little baggie filled with loose pills of different shapes and colours. She picked out two and handed them to me. I swallowed them. Thank you, I said. I have no idea what kind of pills you just gave me. It actually crossed my mind that you might have just given me a date rape drug. Wow, what a good feeling, I thought. I thought it, so I said it, with no possibility of negative consequences. Melissa glanced inscrutably at me. Jim was an engineer for an oil company. I don't want you guys to know, Jim's voice cracked, that I am a drug addict. He made this declaration with such quiet power, it took the room aback. They don't drug test you at your oil company, someone asked Jim. Yes, they do, Jim replied. You don't flunk it, asked Brad. No, said Jim. I haven't flunked it yet. How do you get around it? Asked Brad's friend, Thelma, whose secret was that she watches gay male porn. I don't know, Jim said. What drugs are you addicted to? Brad asked Jim. I like marijuana, Jim said. There was a short silence. How much do you smoke? I asked him. In 3 weeks I'll smoke an ounce of marijuana, said Jim. Is that it? Screeched Emily. I was once very attracted to a man I thought was a woman and ended up spending time with him and paying for the time, Jim said. Everyone looked a little less underwhelmed at Jim's new secret. Mary's secret was how badly she was taking being rejected by her partner, Amanda. I'm 50 and I'm alone, Mary said. She looked at the floor. I've lost myself. Mary wasn't just sitting around moping at home. It was worse than that. She was repeatedly telephoning Amanda. There was a time when Amanda would say to Mary, one day I'll marry you. Now all Amanda was telling her was, stop phoning me. Brad told Mary to take the hot seat. He pointed to an empty chair. "What would you say to Amanda if she was sitting opposite you right now?" Brad asked her. "I'd tell her that I resent her for saying, 'Don't contact me.'" "Say it to her," said Brad. "I resent you for saying, 'Don't call me,'" Mary said quietly into space. "See what it feels like to use an angry voice," Brad said. "Fuck you," Mary yelled at the empty chair. "I resent you for saying one day I'm going to marry you and then you didn't, so fuck you. I resent you because you're such a fucking bitch sometimes. I resent you for treating me like... I resent you for saying all those beautiful things and you took them all back." Mary was sobbing. "Good," Brad said. "When are you going to say this to her face?" Mary swallowed. "I'm wondering at what location." "Call her up," Brad told her. "Say, it's not a request. We're either going to do this alone or in front of your whole goddamn office, and you've got one day to make up your fucking mind." "Okay," said Mary, quietly. "So, when?" Brad said. "By next weekend," Mary said. "Good," Brad said. Jack, a veterinarian sex addict, looked uneasy. "How do you put this approach in the context of people not calling the police?" he asked Brad. "You're asking people to leave this session," I agreed, "and do something to people who aren't part of this. People must get hurt. The police must get called sometimes." "People call the police sometimes," Brad shrugged. "It takes 20 minutes for the police to get there, so you've got 20 minutes to complete all your anger." "I can't imagine this always works out well," I said. "That's because you've been brainwashed your entire life about all the terrible things that are going to happen," Brad said. "Yeah, people get mad. People get upset. But people get over stuff. People worry about what happens in the first 5 seconds. But I'm concerned about the next 5 minutes. I'm committed to people staying with each other until they get over this." "This last part," Brad said, "was critical. You remain with the person you've just been yelling at until the resentments fizzle, and that's how wounds heal." Vincent, the man who was regretting signing up for the course, suddenly announced, "I'm sorry, I'm leaving. This isn't for me. I'm sorry." "I resent you for saying you're leaving," said Melissa. "Okay," said Vincent. "I don't think I will ever get over this resentment," said Melissa. "Wow," I thought. "Give the man a break. She only just met him." "I resent you for telling him that you'll never get over the resentment of him leaving," I told Melissa. "I appreciate you for sitting there listening to me," Melissa said to Vincent. "Thank you," Vincent said. "Shit or get off the pot, man," said Jack, the veterinarian sex addict. "I resent you for saying you're leaving, and I resent that you're still here." Vincent left. The day's session ended. I said I hoped nobody minded, but I was tired and so I wasn't going to have dinner with the group. I was just going to watch TV and send some emails instead. "I feel slighted," said Brad. "Ah, no you don't," I said, although I knew that he did. There was a reason why I needed to go to my room that I hadn't explained to anyone. I had a work crisis. A story I'd been working on had turned chaotic, and my editor and I were at loggerheads, sending each other tense emails. It had sounded like an intriguing story at the beginning. There has been a tradition over the years of journalists wearing disguise to experience injustice firsthand. The pioneer was John Howard Griffin, who in 1959 stained his skin dark and spent 6 weeks hitchhiking as a black man throughout the segregated Deep South, a journey chronicled in his 1961 book, Black Like Me. From time to time, editors have asked me to undertake similar journeys. After 9/11, a TV producer suggested I stain my own skin and move into a Muslim area of London. But it seemed to me like she was basically wanting me to spy on Muslims, so I said no. This time, however, I'd been asked to disguise myself to experience a different injustice. "We want you to be a woman," the editor had said. "We'll work with a prosthetics artist to make you unrecognisable. We'll get a movement coach to teach you how to walk like a woman." "Women and men walk differently," I asked. Yes, she said. I never knew that, I said. This could be really interesting. As a man, I'm rarely stared at lasciviously, but as a woman, I might get stared at lasciviously a lot. How would that make me feel? And do women behave differently when there are no men around, like at women-only gyms and women-only saunas? I'm intrigued. I'll do it. And so I met with a prosthetics artist at a college in West London. She encased my face in alginate and took a cast. A prosthetic mask was made. She spent a couple of weeks manipulating it into womanly features. I slipped it over my face. I looked like a woman with a gigantic head. The editor called me in for a meeting. It's fine, she said. Don't worry. We won't use the prosthetic head. We can still make you look exactly like a woman. Are you sure? I said. You'll be amazed what a few hours with the movement coach will do, she said. You don't think we're in danger of relying too much on the movement coach? I asked. It had been the prosthetics that had rather sold me on the idea. I promise you that we won't let you out of this building unless you absolutely pass as a woman, she said. And so, in an empty conference room in a quiet corner of the magazine's offices, I dressed as a woman. Makeup was applied. I put on a wig and a dress and a padded bra. I spent hours under the tutelage of the movement coach. Test photographs were taken. Finally, I left the conference room and walked in the manner that the movement coach had instructed towards the editor's desk. She swallowed slightly when she saw me. "They've done an incredible job," she said. She turned to the deputy editor. "Haven't they done an amazing job?" The deputy editor swallowed slightly. "Yes," she said. "You look exactly like a woman," said the editor. "Now, go outside and experience life as a woman." "I don't think I look like a woman," I said. "What are you talking about?" said the editor. "You look exactly like a woman." "I don't think I look anything like a woman," I said. She peered at my tormented facial expression. I hesitated for a moment, and then I walked towards the exit. Sweat smudged my foundation. I glanced back over my shoulder at the editors. They were giving me encouraging looks and indicating the door. I felt sick, short of breath. My stomach muscles clenched. And then I stopped. I couldn't do it. I turned, went back downstairs, and I put on my male clothes. A week had passed, and our relationship remained frosty. She felt I'd prevaricated unprofessionally and was acting too sensitive. "Don't overthink it, John," she'd emailed me. "It's just a fun feature. Shouldn't be the cause of some sort of a midlife crisis." I felt that the story's original premise had fallen to pieces, and the reason why they were happy to send me out into the world looking nothing like a woman was because in our line of work, the more humiliated a person is, the more viral the story tends to go. Shame can factor large in the life of a journalist, the personal avoidance of it, and the professional bestowing of it upon others. "Nobody must ever see those test pictures," I'd been thinking all week. Never. For listeners of the audiobook, I should explain that at this point in the physical version of the book, I include a test photograph of me dressed as a woman. And in fact, I do actually look quite a lot like a woman. Quite good looking. Now, as I lay in my hotel room, I understood the truth of it. My terror of humiliation had closed a door. Great adventures that might have unfolded involving me dressed as a woman would never now unfold. I'd been constrained by the terror. It had blown me off course, which actually meant that I was just like the vast majority of people. I knew this from studying the work of David Buss, a professor of evolutionary psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. One day in the early 2000s, Buss had been at a cocktail party when the wife of a friend began flirting with another man in front of everyone. She was a striking woman, Buss later wrote. She looked at her husband derisively and made a derogatory remark about the way he looked, then turned right back to her flirtatious conversation. Buss's friend stomped outside, where Buss found him fuming, saying he felt humiliated and wanted to kill his wife. "I had no doubt that he would do it," Buss wrote. "In fact, he was so wild with rage, such a transformed man. He seemed capable of killing any living thing within an arm's reach. I became frightened for my own life." Buss's friend didn't kill his wife. He calmed down. But the incident shook Buss up, which is why he decided to carry out an experiment. He asked 5,000 people a question. Had they ever fantasized about killing someone? "Nothing," as Buss later wrote in his book The Murderer Next Door, "prepared me for the outpouring of murderous thoughts." It turned out from his survey that 91% of men and 84% of women had experienced at least one vivid fantasy of killing someone. There was the man who imagined hiring an explosive specialist to blow his boss up in his car, the woman who wanted to break every bone in her partner's body, starting with his fingers and toes, then slowly making my way up to larger ones. There was a bludgeoning with a baseball bat, a strangling followed by a beheading, a stabbing during sex. Some people were set on fire. One man was exposed to killer bees. "Murderers are waiting," Buss's book bleakly concluded. "They are watching. They are all around us." Buss's findings deeply distressed him, but I saw them as good news. Surely fantasizing about killing someone and then not doing it is a way we teach ourselves to be moral. So Buss's conclusion seemed silly to me. But there was something different about his study that I found extraordinary. It was something that, as Buss's research assistant Joshua Duntley emailed me, we did not code for specifically. It was the part where Buss asked them what had stimulated their murderous thoughts. There was the boy who daydreamed about kidnapping his schoolmate, breaking both his legs so he couldn't run, beating him until his insides were a bloody pulp, and then I'd tie him to a table and drip acid onto his forehead. What had the schoolmate done to him? He accidentally dropped his books on my head, and all his friends had a good laugh. There was the office worker who imagined tampering with my boss's car brakes so he'd have a braking failure on the motorway. Why? He had given me the impression that I was a real loser. He would mock me in front of other people. I felt ashamed. And on it went. Almost none of the murderous fantasies were dreamt up in response to actual danger, stalker ex-boyfriends, etc. They were all about the horror of humiliation. Brad Blanton was right. Shame internalized can lead to agony. It can lead to Jonah Lehrer, whereas shame let out can lead to freedom, or at least to a funny story, which is a sort of freedom too. And so, there in my room, I decided that on day two of Brad's course, I would go for it. I would let the shame out. I would be Max Mosley. I would be radically honest. On day two, Brad asked me in front of the group if I'd like to take the hot seat, given that I'd been so quiet on day one. I cleared my throat. Everyone was smiling expectantly at me, like I was the start of a good television programme. I hesitated. "Actually, I won't," I said. The expectant smiles turned quizzical. "The truth is," I explained, "I don't think my problems are as bad as everyone else's problems in the room. Plus, I don't like conflict." I clarified that I wasn't against conflict in a weird way. I quite enjoy watching other people being in conflict. If I notice two people yelling at each other on the street, I often stop at a distance and have a look, but it just wasn't my thing to participate in conflict. So I don't want people to think I'm anti-hot seat, I concluded. They'd been my favourite parts of the course so far. I found the lectures in between them quite boring, but the hot seats are great. So you want there to be a hot seat, but you don't want to be the one to get in it, said Brad's friend Thelma. Yes, I said. I say do a hot seat right now. Go ahead and get in it, Thelma said. No, no, I said again. Honestly, I'm more comfortable watching other people do it. Chicken shit, Thelma yelled. I call chicken shit. If you get a chance to jump on John, do, said Brad. Ha ha, I said, but seriously, I've got nothing that's so pressing for me to be in the hot seat. I don't want an awkward silence and I don't want to dredge something up. I'd be faking it. I just think other people have got more issues here than I do. Bullshit, yelled Thelma. You're an arrogant, condescending bastard, said Brad. I don't think I said anything condescending, I said, surprised. You people need it and I don't, said Brad, impersonating me. I actually really resent you for saying that, said Jack, the veterinarian with the sex addiction. It was fucking condescending. I also resent that you're sitting there fiddling with that fucking phone constantly, which I find extremely distracting. I resent you for holding the phone. Can I say something about the phone? I said. We don't give a fuck what your reason is, said Brad. We're going to resent you whether you explain it or not. That's not how conversations work, I said. Ha ha ha, shrieked Thelma. John, do you have a resentment you want to share about anyone in the room? Said Melissa hopefully. I paused. No, I said. I just want you to know that you're a bullshit artist and everything you're saying is bullshit, yelled Brad. Right, I screeched. I resent you, I glared at Jack, for saying I'm condescending. I'm not condescending. I was basing my opinion that your problems are worse than my problems entirely on the things you've all said in this room. And I resent you, I looked at Thelma, for acting like Brad's stooge, like his gang member. There is nothing I dislike more in the world than people who care more about ideology than they do about people. You swamped me with a tidal wave of Brad's ideology. That's a story you've made up about me, shouted Thelma. Yeah, he wants to tell me fucking back off, but he's afraid of the conflict so his mind kicks in. I resent you for repeatedly yelling chicken shit and bullshit at me because, I said. Not because, said Thelma, that's interpretive. I stared open-mouthed at Thelma. She was coaching me. In fact, it dawned on me, none of the yelling was a break from their therapeutic milieu. It was radical honesty. It works wonders for some of Brad's clients, but it wasn't working wonders for me. I was beginning to feel intensely rageful. Do you resent me for telling you what to say? Said Thelma. Yes, I fucking do, I yelled. I fucking massively resent you for telling me what to say. Poor little thing, said Brad. We're so sorry we hurt your tender little feelings. Okay, Brad clapped his hands together. Lunch. I hate to abandon you, John, but I'm going to leave you cooking. The group stood up and began drifting away. They were breaking for lunch. But I'm still very resentful, I said. Good, said Brad. I hope you remain incomplete all lunch. I don't see any value in that at all, I muttered as I put on my jacket. Out in the hotel corridor, Mario, the marijuana dealer, smiled and said, I don't think Brad's finished with you yet. I understood why Mario said that. Brad seemed to have just broken his own golden rule. He hadn't ensured that everyone stayed together while my anger played itself out. No love had been given the chance to grow. I had been cast out into Chicago at an apex of resentfulness. I spent the lunch hour stomping around the streets. After lunch, I only had a few hours before I needed to catch my plane back to New York, so I laid out my complaint for Brad. You broke for lunch right in the middle of it, I said. You left me seething. Melissa leaned over and removed my baseball cap from my head. I flinched. I could have been suicidally unhappy about it, I said. We were running 10 minutes late for lunch, so I made the decision to leave you cooking, Brad said. After that, things moved on. Jack, the veterinarian sex addict who hated me fiddling with my phone, took the hot seat. He recounted a time his father physically attacked his mother in front of him. It was a heartbreaking story. He tightly closed his eyes as he told it, and so I took the opportunity to quickly check Twitter. I hate not knowing what's happening on Twitter. Soon after that, I caught my plane home. We all kept in touch for a while. Mary emailed me to let me know how things had gone with Amanda. I tried the rad-on approach and she was super resistant and defensive and pretty much closed to what I wanted to express, she wrote. I could feel the waves of anger coming off her while talking to her. Since then I've had to still see her at the gym and at times I've ignored her. Other times we've had civil, pleasant chats. Not that many. Another member of the group emailed us all to report that he attempted radical honesty on his wife, but she responded by trying to physically push him away, and so he told her that he would get the axe and defend myself by killing you. Rightfully, she was scared, as she knows that often I confuse truth with fantasy. We all do. So the police came by. I am under consideration for a job that involves a security clearance, so any arrest will result in no offer there. I love you all, especially Thelma, who I find extremely attractive, and I want to have sex with her, you. Perhaps I could even treat her, you, as my wife. Brad wrote back, copying everyone in. What you say is completely insane. Your best bet is to seek out a psychiatrist who can prescribe you a mild tranquilizer. My radical honesty weekend had not been a success for me. But I continue to believe that Max Mosley's own version of it, as soon as the victim steps out of the pact by refusing to feel ashamed, the whole thing crumbles, had indeed been his magic formula, the reason why he'd soared above his shaming. And I continue to believe it, right up until a new public shaming unfolded, this time up in Kennebunk, Maine, that forced me to rethink the whole thing. This new shaming made me realise that Max had survived his for a completely different reason, one I hadn't put my finger on. Chapter 9. A town abuzz over prostitution and a client list. Kennebunk, Maine. The summer people who clogged the roads here are long gone, and the leaves have turned crimson and orange. But the prevailing sentiment in this postcard-perfect coastal town these days is one of dread. For more than a year, the police have been investigating reports that the local Zumba instructor, Alexis Wright, was using her exercise studio on a quaint downtown street for more than fitness training. In fact, the police say, she was running a one-woman brothel with up to 150 clients and secretly videotaping them as they engaged in intimate acts. The list is rumoured to be replete with the names of prominent people. Catherine Q. Seeley, New York Times, 16th of October 2012. President George H.W. Bush has his seaside compound, Walker's Point, 4 miles away from Kennebunk, up in Kennebunkport. Sometimes blacked-out cars zoom through town on their way up there, carrying Vladimir Putin or Bill Clinton or Nicolas Sarkozy. But besides that, not much happens in Kennebunk, or not much did. Who might be on the list? A member of the Bush family? Someone from the Secret Service? General Petraeus? Bethany McLean, Town of Whispers, Vanity Fair, 1st of February 2013. A defence attorney, Stephen Schwartz, petitioned the Maine Supreme Court to have the names on the list remain secret. He was representing two of the unnamed men. This was still Puritan country, he argued. Once they're released, they're all going to have the mark of a scarlet letter. But the judge ruled against him, and the Kennebunk newspaper, the York County Coast Star, started to publish. There were 69 people on the list in all. 68 men and one woman. Sadly, no Bush was among them, not even a member of the family's security detail, but there were Kennebunk society people, a pastor from the South Portland Church of the Nazarene, a lawyer, a high school hockey coach, a former town mayor, a retired school teacher, and his wife. This was a unique event in the public shaming world. Mass disgrace scenarios like this never happen. Given that my job had become to try and match personality nuances with public shaming survival levels, it was a dream come true for me. When do you get a sample size like that? Surely, amongst the people on the list, there would be those so eager to please they'd allow strangers' negative opinions of them to meld with their own, creating some corrosive amalgamate. There'd be those so desperate not to lose their status, it would need to be prized from their clenched fingers. There'd be serious people like Jonah, hitherto smart alecky people like Justine, and there'd be Max Mosley's. Kennebunk was like a well-stocked laboratory for me. Who would incur the crowd's wrath? Who its mercy? Who'd be shattered? Who'd emerge unscathed? I drove up there. Inside Court 1 of the Biddeford District Courthouse, half a dozen of the men from the Zumba list sat on the benches, staring grimly ahead while news crews pointed their cameras at them. We in the press area were allowed to stare at them, and they weren't able to look away. It reminded me of how Nathaniel Hawthorne had described the pillory in The Scarlet Letter, an instrument of discipline so fashioned as to confine the human head in its tight grasp and thus hold it up to public gaze. The very ideal of ignominy was embodied and made manifest in this contrivance of wood and iron. There can be no outrage, methinks, more flagrant than to forbid the culprit to hide his face for shame. Everyone was silent and a little awkward, as if we were all standing around in some strange pre-consensus limbo. This story was new. There hadn't been time for Kennebunk society to start shunning the men. However brutally or subtly the shunning might manifest itself, nothing had happened yet. I was in on the ground floor. The judge entered, and it began. The court proceedings were nothing much. The men were in turn told to stand up and plead guilty or not guilty. Each man pleaded guilty. Fines were imposed, $300 for each visit to Alexis Wright. The maximum fine today was $900, and then it was over. They were allowed to leave, and they did, hurriedly. I followed the last one out. All the others had vanished except for him. I introduced myself to him. "You can interview me," he said, "but I want something in return." "Okay," I said. "Money," he said. "I'm not talking about much. Just enough to buy my kid a present from Walmart. Just a voucher from Walmart. And then I'll tell you all the details. I'll tell you everything. What me and Alexis got up to." He was a heavy man. He gave me a look of desperate, sad, faux lasciviousness, like he was offering me the best erotic novel. "I'll tell you everything," he said. I said I couldn't pay someone to talk about his or her crime, so he shrugged and walked away. I drove back to New York, and the next day I wrote to all the 68 men and one woman on the list requesting interviews. And then I waited. A few days later, an email arrived. "Okay, we can talk. I am the former Church of the Nazarene pastor that unfortunately became involved in this whole mess. Sincerely yours, James Andrew Ferreira." "Hello, John." Andrew Ferreira's voice was kind, tired, and lost-sounding, a formerly chipper community leader trying to adapt to a world that might no longer have any interest in his leadership. This was the first time he'd agreed to talk to a journalist. He said the last few days had been hard. His wife had left him, He'd been fired from his job. All that had been inevitable, he said, but the rest was unknown. The extent to which the community would cast him out and how he'd deal with it. Unknown. I asked him why he had visited Alexis Wright. Maybe my marriage wasn't great, he replied. It wasn't horrible. It was just sort of drifting. Cohabiting, to a point. Anyway, I was reading a story in the Boston Globe on the Craigslist killer. You remember the story? He murdered a 20-something call girl, and the Boston Globe said that most of the ads for escorts have migrated away from Craigslist and onto Backpage.com. If somebody wants an escort or a happy-ending massage or something, Backpage.com. And I just remembered it. I wish I hadn't. Unfortunately, some things just stick in your mind. I became tainted with the information. Andrew visited Alexis 3 times, he said. On the last occasion, we shared a laugh. We both just belly laughed. That was outside of what I was there for. And she became human to me then. She was no longer an object. And that was the puncturing of the fantasy. It was anything I could do to get out of there. I'm not one to wear my emotions on my sleeve, but I bawled my eyes out in the car. And that was his last visit to Alexis Wright. How have you been spending the past few days? I asked him. I don't just sit at home and isolate, he replied. I've joined a meet-up group. It's just a bunch of people and I'm completely anonymized there. I show up and we play board games, Risk and Apples to Apples and Pandemic. Besides that, I've been journaling. What do I do with all this information? If I wait a little bit, 6 months, a year, and I try to send out a manuscript, is that something that would be received? Like a memoir, I asked. Could I utilise that to springboard into a new ministry? He said. And what angle do I come at it at? I could go faith-based and warn men not to do it, or I could take a completely different tack and, well, I don't want to become a champion for legalised prostitution, so I've really got to think about what all this means. He drifted off. What do I do with this? He said again. I don't know yet. Unfortunately, I am 49 years old, and I've turned a great deal of my life into a cautionary tale. Have you met any of the other men or the woman from the list? I asked. No, he said. We're all members of a club we didn't realise we were in. There's really no reason or opportunity for any contact or solidarity. So mainly you're just waiting for whatever happens next to happen, I said. Yeah, he said. That's the worst. The expectation. It's horrible. Andrew promised to let me know the moment his shaming began. Online, in town, anywhere. At the first hint of it, he assured me he'd call. We said our goodbyes, and that was the last I heard from him for several months. So I telephoned him again. He sounded happy to get my call. I never heard from you, I said. What happened? It went away, he said. There was no shaming at all, I said. None, he said. My imagination had been far worse than what actually happened. Justine Sacco was annihilated, I said, and Joan Alera too, of course. But Justine Sacco, and she didn't do anything wrong, and you got nothing. I don't have an answer for that, Andrew said. I don't understand it. In fact, my relationship with my 3 daughters has never been stronger. My youngest one noted, it's like getting to know you all over again. Your transgression made them see you as human, I said. Yes, Andrew said. Huh, I said. Justine and Jonah's transgressions made people see them as the opposite of human. His marriage was over, he added, as was his job as a pastor in the local Nazarene church. That wasn't coming back. but otherwise he had experienced only kindness and forgiveness. Actually, it wasn't kindness and forgiveness. It was something much better than that. It was nothing. He experienced nothing. Andrew told me a story. When Alexis Wright's business partner Mark Strong was on trial for bankrolling the brothel, Andrew was ordered into court. There was a chance he'd be called as a witness, so he was sequestered into a private room at the back. After a while, six other men drifted into the room. They all nodded at each other, but sat in silence. Then some tentative conversations ensued, and they realised what they'd suspected. They were Alexis Wright clients. They were all men from the list. This was the first time they'd met, so they hurriedly, quite eagerly, swapped notes. Not about their visits to Alexis, everybody tiptoed awkwardly around that, but about what happened next, once they were outed. One man was saying, "It cost me a new SUV for my wife," Andrew said. Another said, "It cost me a cruise to the Bahamas and a new kitchen." Everyone was laughing. None of them had fallen victim to any kind of shaming, I asked. "No," said Andrew. "It went away for them, too." But there was one exception, Andrew said. The conversation between them turned to the one woman who had visited Alexis. "Everyone was laughing about her," Andrew said. Then suddenly this one older gentleman, who had been much quieter than the others, said, "That was my wife." Oh, John, you could feel the energy shift. Everything changed immediately. "What kind of jokes had you all been making about the wife?" I asked. "I don't remember exactly," Andrew said. "They had been more mocking. She was looked at differently by the men, and yes, with her it was considered more shameful." As it happens, Max and Andrew's sins would, in Puritan times, have been judged graver than Jonah's. Jonah, guilty of lying or publishing false news, would have been fined, placed in the stocks for a period not exceeding 4 hours, or publicly whipped with not more than 40 stripes, according to Delaware law, whereas Max and Andrew, having defiled the marriage bed, would have been publicly whipped, no maximum number of lashes was specified, imprisoned with hard labour for at least a year, and, on a second offence, imprisoned for life. But the shifting sands of shameworthiness had shifted away from consensual sex scandals, if you're a man, to work improprieties and perceived white privilege, and I suddenly understood the real reason why Max had survived his shaming. Nobody cared. Max survived his shaming because he was a man in a sex shaming, which meant there had been no shaming. I emailed Max to tell him. "Nobody cared," I wrote. "Of all the public scandals, being a man in a sex scandal is probably the one to hope for." Max was the target of no one. Not liberals like me. Not the online misogynists who tear apart women who step out of line. Max suffered nothing. An hour passed. Then Max emailed back. "Hi, Ron. I think you're spot on."
It wasn't that nobody cared. Max's wife cared. And someone else did. Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail. In a 2008 speech to the Society of Editors, Paul Dacre called Max's orgy perverted, depraved, the very abrogation of civilised behaviour. It was a rueful speech lamenting the death of shame. Dacre portrayed Justice Eadie, the judge who found in Max's favour in the privacy case against the News of the World, as its incarnation. The judge found for Max Mosley because he had not engaged in a sick Nazi orgy, as the News of the World contested, though for the life of me it seems an almost surreally pedantic logic, as some of the participants were dressed in military-style uniform, Mosley was issuing commands in German while one prostitute pretended to pick lice from his hair, a second filleted him, and a third caned his backside until blood was drawn. To Justice Edie, such behaviour was merely unconventional. What is most worrying about Justice Edie's decisions is that he is ruling that, when it comes to morality, the law in Britain is now